The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to Moto POD, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 252 for Friday, the 5th of November, 2010. My name is Jim Race. I'm here in California in some very unseasonably warm weather, and Martin Darlington is with me from the UK in probably some freakishly strange weather as well. How are you, Martin?
Yeah, we're in very seasonably windy weather. Jim, what happened to the G?
G?
Yeah, we normally welcome people to MotoG POD, but we're welcoming them to Moto POD.
Oh, we had to give away a consonant.
right.
Not enough donations coming in, which is a total lie, by the way. But ladies and gentlemen, you've heard us talk a little bit about some mild changes and nothing of a big deal, really. But MotoGPOD is going to change to MotoPOD or MotoPod, as it were. You folks out there need to do absolutely nothing, at least for the time being, and we will give you plenty of warning if you do need to do so. But MotoGPOD.com will, at least for the nonce, be available, as well as the new URL, drumroll please, of MotoPodcast.com, which, if you think about it, kind of makes sense because we certainly cater to all forms of tarmac-based road racing, two-wheeled road racing motorsport. And it's also kind of a little bit of a thing that we've worked out with Dorna and totally cool about that. And so moving forward, whatever we need to change, email addresses won't change. Everything will just be migrated over slowly. But if you want to go to www.motopodcast.com, you can see the future. It's still under construction. If something doesn't work, let us know. You can send contact to me at race@motogpod.com, or I believe motopodcast.com as well. I'm not sure if I've got that set up yet, but whatever. Regardless, relax. Don't worry about it. We'll get it taken care of. So that's what happened, Martin. And you knew this was coming anyway, so thank you for playing along.
and clacking away and giving Jules a bit more editing.
Yes, indeed. We will carry the G in our hearts fondly. The logo remains almost exactly the same, so carrying on the brand, as you will. Donations this week, two excellent ones from two long-term friends of the show, one from Jamie McVeigh, who's we've read a bunch of his letters in the past, Martin.
Yep.
Also one from David Chiberti, who has contributed to the show before, and I'm pretty sure I mentioned his name. He is heavily involved with FastTrackRiders.com, a track day organization in Southern California, and definitely a friend of the show, and in fact extended a invite to Mark Miller to run a track day soon. So maybe that'll happen, maybe it won't. Speaking of Mark, Mark will be on the show next week, and it's pretty much scheduled at this point for his pre-Macau information, and judging by all the emails and information that you guys have been sending in to us, you pretty much can't wait. And frankly, Martin, I didn't actually include this in the show notes, but you and I, and certainly all of the MotoGP or POD fans or Motopod fans, have to look forward to, in a very kind of heartsick sort of way, is the true winding down of the race season, the potential doldrums. So at least we've got Mark to keep us moving forward.
Absolutely. I've been wondering whether this weekend's race is going to create more press attention or the test afterwards. There's going to be an awful lot of people looking at that.
That's an incredibly good point, because some of the shuffling, well, not that, that would be the understatement of the century, at least in Grand Prix racing land, the shuffling that we have going on this coming week. And in fact, I heard a quick little thing is apparently, you and I talked about this, I believe, last week, is that Alex Briggs and the rest of the Yamaha team have been freed so that they can participate in the test with Ducati on Valentino Rossi's side. Now, as we chit-chatted a bit, that, you know, we're certainly not going to dive right in and, you know, thank you, here's the keys, you know, here we go. Probably more an observational point of view. But we are a bit getting ahead of ourselves, are we not?
We certainly are.
We had some email. I want you to run through those, and I'll walk through some of them as well.
Yep, we had a great one from Nick Codling, who's a Brit who listens to the show, and we've communicated with Nick on a number of occasions. He lives on the Isle of Wight, which is an island off the south coast of England, and he commutes to Portsmouth by ferry. And he said he was very busy at work. He got a bit behind listening to the podcast, and he was listening with earphones to the episode where Jules said Lorenzo is a nerd, at which point he laughed out loud and had everyone staring at him. And there was some very complimentary feedback in there. So thanks, Nick, and that certainly made us chuckle.
Yeah, no, we hear that all the time. Because we're not like a regular radio show, and sometimes we blurt things out that are certainly, I know they make me laugh when I say them, and I've had enough feedback now where people are mildly to highly entertained or amused by it. So we'll try and keep that up. But I appreciate hearing that kind of stuff. It's like, okay, maybe we didn't make your morning, but at least we gave you a chuckle when things were a little bit better than reading the dry newspaper.
I like that. I think it was the same episode, and Jules was saying about Lorenzo getting pelters from the Rossi fans for having the nerve to beat him. And he said, and he's getting so much shit, and you could hear him thinking, what word can I use? No, the only word that will do here is shit, so I'm just going to say it.
Yep. Additional emails. Carry on, because that's your side of the pond, sir.
Yeah, we've had an email from Simon, who's UK, Northern Ireland based, and he's invited yourself, Jim.
Indeed.
If you're coming across for the Isle of Man, he said, look, get across a bit earlier, and you've got the Northwest 200. And his father, Simon's father, was the spannerer, or the one of the mechanics for Alan Irwin, who was a quite legendary road racer across in Ireland in the 80s and 90s. And he's basically offered to put Jim up. And, of course, if you get across to the mainland, we'll do the same. And we also had a really cool email, which is I've just been reading this morning, has expanded from Mitch Reichard. Have I been saying that right, Reichard?
Reichard, but I'm sure it'll be close enough for him.
Regarding the flat trackers and the Indy Mile and Nicky Hayden jumping on a bike. And, you know, I remember that happening and thinking, well, you know, it's an exhibition ride. And Mitch really pointing out how impressive it is for a road racer like Nicky, albeit with a fair amount of dirt riding history, mm-hmm. to jump on and do flat tracking. And it's something that we don't really know about here. We have Speedway, which is similar, but very, very specialised. Going round and round and round a small dirt track. But the flat tracking is obviously huge across in the States, and it's not something to really know about. So that's something we're likely to cover in a future show in the off-season, and very much look forward to that.
Yeah, and indeed, as we get more and more feedback and email and kind of draw people out of the depths, or people that have a lot of experience in the industry, just an FYI, keep that kind of stuff in, because I think what I'm going to try to put together, if we can pull it off, Martin, is maybe a bit of a mechanical roundtable with pulling a bunch of these people in that have been at the heart and soul of road racing, dirt track, real roads, people from the mechanical side, and get, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 of these people on the line at the same time and just kind of have a throwdown and get some great stories out of them.
Well, we haven't spoken to Liam for far too long, so that would be a very good excuse to get Liam on board again.
Absolutely. In fact, I was thinking about that just last night. So, Liam, if you're listening, you're on the docket, sir. you had a couple of miscellaneous things that were interesting.
Yeah, we've got it's Guy Fawkes Night across here in the UK, otherwise known as Fireworks Night, and it's remembering the unsuccessful attempt to blow up the Houses of Parliament in 1605 by a Guido Fawkes, who was a Spanish-Irish chap who didn't like the government, and so he decided to stick a load of gunpowder underneath it, otherwise known as the Gunpowder Plot. And basically, these days, it's just a great excuse to let off a load of fireworks on the 5th of November.
And you practically, they probably were blowing out the fuse through the whole thing, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it didn't work, because, you know, we make shoddy things that never go off when they're meant to.
Well, it's always damp there, too.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, November under the floors of a London, you know, in the cellars of a London building. I mean, you can't expect things to work. But talking about things going off, we also, and we're sort of slightly getting ahead of ourselves, but
that's all right.
We've seen the Alpine, we've seen a Dainese airbag jackets that Lorenzo and Rossi have been wearing for a couple of years now. And we'll all remember, no doubt, at Donington when Jorge's went off but then failed to deflate, which he's meant to do within 20 seconds, and he walked off looking like a linebacker. And, hey, check me out with my American football references.
Well done. You guys just had, the 49ers in Denver playing over in London, right? Did you watch that?
That's right, yeah. No, I didn't get to see it because we were out when it was on, but absolutely packed house.
Yeah.
Huge. Yeah. Super. I used to watch it. It used to be on free-to-air television in the 80s and 90s. I got quite into it and followed Miami Dolphins purely on the basis it was somewhere I'd been. And well, it was either that or the Seattle Seahawks. I thought I'll follow the Dolphins because they had Dan Marino and he seemed quite cool for a bloke in his 40s. And
hey, what are you saying?
Yeah, I know that's terrible, isn't it?
Well, you're notching us out, my friend.
Yeah. I've got my next little milestone coming up at the end of this month.
Really? Well, we might as well get it out there. When is your birthday, Martin?
25th of November.
That's Thanksgiving.
Is it?
Or thereabouts, I think.
I'll certainly be giving thanks for making it to 45. That's quite surprising.
Well, an early happy birthday. Maybe somebody will send you a little surprise pack. Maybe I'll send you some fresh stickers. Did you ever get that?
Yeah.
Did you ever get that sticker
pack? Yeah. No, we've got the stickers yet.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And we used to have a thing called Zap stickering. When I was in the Army, you'd have a little squadron badge. And you'd have it on, you know, a roll of little paper self-adhesive stickers. And if you ever visited another squadron, you'd go around sticking your squadron stickers all over their furniture, aircraft, heads, anything you could get away with, really.
I haven't seen one on your airborne transport yet.
No. But I was thinking, well, I'll wait till we update the name and then I can do that. But I thought if we ever get into... you know when Mo and Jules visited the Eurosport commentary box?
Oh, yeah.
Now, that would be a prime target.
Would it not?
Across the middle of their monitor. No, that probably wouldn't go down very well.
I'm going to, Mark, I know that you listen to the show, you know that we're poor in profits, but rich in heart. I'm going to send you a sticker or two, and if you can find a place to put it on your bike... when you're zipping around the streets of Macau, they are laminated, so they should work well against Armco or whatever you happen to glance against. Please paste it up.
How cool would that be?
That would be pretty damn cool.
The point that was being made was that Alpine Stars have been putting out quite a lot of press saying, the new Alpine Stars airbag jacket, which has been in development since 2003, will be on sale in spring 2011. Well, if they're selling it in the next few months, it's got to be pretty much done. Why hasn't Danny Pedrosa been wearing one? And if he had, would he have walked away from the Motegi crash just like... Because Jorge's crash at Estoril, which we're about to come on to in free practice, I'm not giving anything away about the race, but he had a crash in free practice, a mini high side, but he was fairly well launched, landed on his shoulder, but his airbag had gone off, so he just walked away.
Yeah.
Bit bruised, but nothing worse. And you just think, you know, why wasn't Danny wearing one of these things?
You kind of have to wonder, but I mean, frankly, an awful lot. Even in my shitty little world of racing, the slightest little things, especially with your gear, kind of throw you off. And there's a real good reason. You see even Rossi, for example, doing his thong picking, if you will.
Yeah.
Is that it's not necessarily even a ritual, but, I used to remember pulling my knee pads up, doing all sorts of adjustments before I'd head out for a warm-up lap. And the tiniest little thing can throw you off. And maybe it just didn't work for him. Maybe there wasn't any room. underneath the leathers. But the same thing that, as you mentioned with Lorenzo, he certainly did have a bit of a bulk there, and I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't throw some ab protection in there, a nice little six-pack for the same thing. You know, I was chasing down last year an interview with the engineers that put together the Dainese airbag system, and they wanted me to travel to Italy to actually facilitate the interview, and if not for that, down to LA. But at the time, I wasn't timing wise, it wasn't working well. So, Dainese folks out there, if you would like to speak with us regarding this, we'd love to hear it. Definitely some tech that is up and coming. Ooh, we are moving through here slow. Let's get on to the premiere series that we had at Estoril, Portugal last weekend. How about that, Martin?
Excellent. And should we do it in the order in which the races ran, which was rather strange?
It was, and I think that's an excellent idea. Let's make sure that we talk about weather conditions, too, as we head into each of these. Well, you know, actually, let's back it up a little bit, because we could run through the races, but I think it is important prior to that, and we can just mix this up as we want to, talking about the weirdness of the weather this weekend, because it certainly did create a lot of unusual conditions. We knew going into Estoril that weather was going to be iffy, and it's always iffy there. They're just a couple miles off the coast, and inland, not off the coast, a small island. And it's my understanding, and I'm just throwing this out off the top of my head, that they are changing the date for it next year to try and compensate for that. Regardless, the weather was going to be shifting and changeable, and indeed it was. And on Friday, we were reverting to the same thing that we had at Aragon with the FP1 and FP2. However, that didn't quite work out as planned, and even more so on Saturday. And you take it from there.
Yeah, I mean, on the Friday, it was all wet sessions, but and the MotoGP class didn't even, or very few, I think it was only Hiroshi Ayama actually went out and posted a lap, which was something like 14 seconds slower than they subsequently did in the wet, because conditions were awful. The 125s had been out and been taken a right battering. Then conditions deteriorated. MotoGP didn't go out. And then Moto2 did. And right towards the end of the session, a couple of people managed to get out on slicks. About half a dozen got out on slicks as there was a drying line appearing. On the Saturday, it started similarly. And they said, yep, no, it's still wet. And it's still windy. The winds were causing as many problems as the water was. Mm-hmm. And then we had FP1 and 2 on Friday, FP3 Saturday morning, and then Saturday afternoon, the heavens opened. I watched a shot of the safety car going around. It had a bow wave. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was, and that's not hyperbole. I mean, it really genuinely was create. There was ripples coming off the front tyres as they went through these huge lakes that were being created, and they just said, no, it's not safe, we cannot go out there. So qualifying didn't happen, and they took the aggregate free practice times to create the grids for the three classes, and that threw up some interesting starting grids.
It did. And on top of that, it also left a few people out, probably most notably and also currently in the news, one Mike DiMeglio, who did not make the 100% cut, or 107% cutoff. But strangely enough, a few other people that didn't did. So I don't think it's politics. Well, maybe it is. I refuse to speculate on that at this point. But that being said, it certainly led into Sunday with a whole bunch of guys that had essentially no true dry weather practice. Sunday morning warm-up was also wet and changeable conditions, and pretty much to a rider, they were all wishing for a wet race.
Yeah, because all the riders were saying, what's the worst scenario? And they said, wet practice, wet qualifying, or wet qualifying didn't actually happen, wet warm-up, dry race. And that's exactly what happened. It was, so they basically, they were saying the grid's shaken up anyway because of the fact that qualifying didn't occur. And there is an element of lottery. There was a brilliant little interview they did with Rossi in the, I think it was the post-free practice, as it turned out, qualifying interview. and they said, you know, what's it going to be like for the race? And he mimed flipping a coin and saying, yeah, you just have to go with your best guess. And they were talking to the Eurosport guys had been speaking to a couple of the mechanics who'd said, we can't use Phillip Island settings because Phillip Island is a unique track and the settings you have there don't really work. Obviously, a lot of the teams will have had stuff from last year, but everything's changed since then. So there really was an element of, wow, this could be a bit of a nightmare, and we might see some unusual people running at the front.
I think the only real difference that the weather truly made, besides what you're thinking of, is not only pride, but chasing down the manufacturers' championships in the various classes. We know that the 125s clearly still had. We'll get into that one, and we'll get into the rest of them as well. But 125s is still to be decided, but Moto 2 and MotoGP are already done. So there's a lot of racing for pride and for a bit of mind games, if you really think about it, heading into the upcoming season. So, just kind of weird. And as it turned out, for the most part, 125 certainly had a bit of weather to contend with, but MotoGP and Moto 2 pretty much got off, not scot-free, but pretty well.
Yeah, and if anyone hasn't seen these yet, and you're listening to the podcast, we are going to be putting spoilers out there, obviously. So if you've got them recorded, stop the podcast now. Watch all three races. They are incredible. Brilliant races.
And watch one of them again.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was a really good weekend of racing, and some real surprises, and not our usual Estoril, if you think about it. Although Estoril certainly has had its drama in the past, but a drama-filled day. All right, so let's roll through this, and as always, and because you are so damn good at it, I will let you lead through the race details, my friend.
Well, on Moto2. One of the notable wild cards we had was Keenan Sofuoglu, who will be running in Moto2 next year. I say he will be. It's not, nothing's been rubber stamped yet, but we're pretty sure he is. And he's come across from World Supersport, where, of course, he's the newly crowned champion for the second time. And he's running on Shoya Tomizawa's Technomag CIP bike. And he was on it in the wet. Unfamiliar bike. Okay, obviously there's going to be similarities to his World Supersport bike, but it is a prototype, or it's a prototype chassis, at a track he's never ridden at before, certainly at the higher levels.
I should mention right here that while it was in the wet, it was a semi-drying track, and pretty much all the riders went out on slicks, and this was also his first time on slicks on that bike.
Well, that was it. When we got to the race, he's suddenly on a dry setup, which he hasn't ridden at all. And he went.
Yes, he did.
He was on the front row. He qualified on the front row from the free practice aggregates. And he led and basically started to just disappear. And we were all a bit, well, I was sat there watching it thinking, how on earth is he managing to do this? It was incredibly impressive. And he ate his tyres, basically. Mm-hmm. But he shot off. There was a chasing pack, and I'm struggling to remember the actual chronological sequences that we saw.
It's impossible.
For the first time this season, Tony Elias DNF'd, mm-hmm. and that's incredible. Penultimate race, and he DNF'd for the very first time this season. He was fine, the bike wasn't, and that was the end of Tony's run. And we ended up with a pack, and there were quite a few people you could see were at first appeared to be circulating, and then as they got used to the setup and where it worked and where it didn't, started to punt their way through the pack. And we had some unusual names up there, Stefan Bradl, who eventually, well, we'll get to this, who finished where. But Keenan ran out the front and then slowly was getting hunted down by Bradl and Baldellini, Alex De Angelis, Scott Redding, Ant West, Rafael De Rosa, and Gabor Talmashi, who'd been at the front chasing Keane and then slowly drop back. These guys were all either going backwards in Gabor's case or coming forwards. We also had Andrea Iannone, who went, he had an incredible run. He went from, I think he started in the 30s.
Yeah, I think 34th. And again, the man can come back from a long ways back. I think there is, of course, the farther you get towards the front in that mad dash, not only are you going to shag off your tires, but you're also going to be running into people that are harder and harder to pass. And it kind of made me wonder, because I saw that come in, it kind of made me wonder, you know, do you bide your time just a little bit? Because, you know, it's hard to say.
He was getting onto podium positions really, really quick with enough of the race left. And he pushed and pushed and crashed. And he remounted and ended up 21st. So, I mean, Iannone doing what he's done all season, entertaining the crowd.
Yep.
You know, it was fantastic to see, but you couldn't help thinking, you just pushed a little bit too hard there. We had a number of other riders who would push their way towards the front. Julien Simon made steady progress and scored points, but wasn't on it the way we've seen him most of the season. And as it shook out, we had Bradl and Baldellini slowly catching Keenan. Then they got past. Keenan appeared to go backwards, and at one point was down to 8th or 9th, I think, before he rallied towards the end. And as they came across the line, we had Bradl for his first win for, well, since 125 days.
Yep.
Alex Baldellini on the podium, his first podium this season on Moto2. And then we had Alex De Angelis and Scott Redding mugged Keenan on the very last lap. And Scott went from 8th to 4th.
Yeah, truly the last couple of laps with that trio was, a larger, it was highly entertaining.
Yeah, and Alex De Angelis pipped Scott by 12 thousandths of a second.
Again.
Then Keenan in 5th. And Keenan in 5th, I mean, that is really, I know we talk in the Premier class about the big gap, or Rossi certainly talked about the big gap between World Superbikes and MotoGP. Well, World Supersport and Moto2, the very top level, I'd say, is a lot closer. And I'm sure Eugene was watching that with keen interest.
No, according to Eugene, and I...
yeah, that was brilliant.
you saw that particular tweet?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so those of you that are not on Twitter, I'll tell you what, we'll put a link in that. Remind me at the end of the show, Martin, to that particular tweet. Something about polishing his trophies.
Yes, yeah.
So, yeah, good on for Keenan. It's nice to see, and in fact, to be fair, I think what it does is it creates an opportunity to speculate on the competitive, to speculate on the competitiveness of the pseudo-spec class at MotoGP with the quote-unquote production-based bikes of World Supersport. And in fact, it bodes well because that may actually encourage additional crossover, even though there's so many teams and riders that want to get into the MotoGP paddock and trying to do that there, but of course Dorman is limiting the amount of entries. So we'll have to see.
Yeah, absolutely. But like you say, bodes well for the future. Rafael de Rosa came in 6th. Ant West had a really good weekend on the MZ Racing team. He was 7th. Gabor Talmashi eventually finished 8th, having been running at the front. Dominic Agata was 9th, and Carol Abraham 10th. And then on down through the pack, we had only 8 retirees, which was quite good.
Yeah, considering. Absolutely. Yep.
Yeah. And notably, Tony Elias already mentioned, Robbie Rolfo, Kenny Noyes was a shame to see that didn't go, and Ratapark Willerott, the Thai rider, also on the Bimeter, also crashed out.
Yep.
But at the end of it, we have got Tony Elias, obviously crown champion, and 271 points. Julien Simon, 185, and only 6 points behind Andrea Iannone. So there is a lot for them to fight for at Valencia this weekend. Thomas Luthi can't catch Iannone, and Simone Corsi is back in 5th.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the big reason that they're having, or at least not they, but Iannone is having these bonsai runs from the back, because if he wants to even try and retain a hope of getting a second place, which, folks out there, does matter. You know, there's kind of always a joke, you know, came in second, now you're the first loser, but it does matter. Those numbers actually are important. And so you will have to see how that ends up.
And moving on to MotoGP, drama before we'd even started. We had the sighting lap, because we had this situation where it was a dry track and they hadn't had any dry setup time. A lot of the guys went out early, put in a lap, came back into the pits with the pit lane still open, you know, maybe made a couple of adjustments, then went out again to line up onto the grid, during which Ben Spies crashed. And he crashed and has dislocated his left ankle, which apparently he's done three times this season in his various crashes. So it might be that his left ankle's a bit of a weak point, but he was quite clearly in some discomfort and was unable to start. So that was Ben out, which was a real shame. Mm-hmm. They all lined up, and from the start, we had Stoner, who was, I think, was he third row? Second row?
Yes, indeed.
Made a blinding start. Jorge got a good start off the line. Valentino got a little bit mugged and ended up dropping, going back a few places. So we had Lorenzo, Stoner, Nicky Hayden banged his way past and was leading for a while. We had Alex Espargaro crashed out on lap one, and therefore he's classified as not having started, even though he did, because he didn't complete the lap. And then the race started to settle down. Lorenzo retook the lead, and Valentino came through and was chasing the two Ducatis, and we had another Casey Stoner crash. Front end just washed out.
One thing I was thinking when I saw that, actually the first thing that came to mind when I saw that is, and we know that it wasn't a, well, we sort of know that it really wasn't a mechanical issue that he was having in his first season with LCR, but most of his crashes back then came from washing out the front end. And so clearly the 2011 Honda is going to be much more developed than the second tier bike that he had with LCR back in the day, and that was actually, I believe that was the first year for LCR to put together a MotoGP team. They're stepping into the highest ranks of the premier classes, and I've done all those interviews with Ciccanello, and I've never actually asked him about, how did I manage to not ask him about 2006?
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, obviously, a lot of people saw something in Casey which was then developed and culminated in the 2007 championship and may well culminate in another one in the future. But I remember that 06 season was, I mean, it wasn't win or bin, it was just bin and bin.
Yeah, but I mean, you have to remember that, I mean, what he picked up a pole at the first race, I believe. I mean, that.
Yeah.
It's kind of impressive. I think it was Qatar.
The first race.
Might have been the second. It was a Qatar, I believe.
Because they did Qatar open the season? I can't remember. But certainly, I remember when they were talking about him, and I think it was Kenny Roberts Sr. coming out with another of his great lines, and he said, you can teach a fast crasher not to crash, but you can't teach a slow, safe guy to go quicker.
Yep, indeed.
And certainly the truth of that has been borne out. So Casey went down again. He wasn't hurt. He looked very, very hacked off. And I'm really been impressed with the way that, even though he's going, him and the Ducati team, they don't look any different to the way they have for the last 3 years. You know, they're still doing everything they can. Of course, it's his team who will be going with him. So then we had Jorge out front. Valentino got past Nicky Hayden. And then he fairly comfortably got past Jorge. And started to open a gap, which at one point I think was just touching 2 seconds. And I thought, okay, Valentino's obviously got something going here, and Jorge hasn't. But a bit like Moto2, you could almost see people starting to settle down, learn the bike, how it's behaving on that track in differing conditions to what they'd seen all weekend. And Jorge started to reel him back in. And we had Dovi in a reasonably comfortable third position for a while, being hunted by Marco yeah. Simoncelli. And a really good battle developed behind with Dovi, Marco Simoncelli, Nicky Hayden, Randy Depugne. Colin got in amongst it a couple of times, but then would drop back a little bit. Danny Pedrosa still obviously quite injured further back from that, and then the rest of the guys behind. Notably, Carlos Checa pulled out. It was arm pump. And I suppose that just illustrates the differences between a World Superbike and a MotoGP bike. The harder braking bit he pulled in, and he looked quite disgruntled, and I thought, well, there's obviously a mechanical. And then we heard, no, it's him. He's obviously finding quite difficult to come back. So it'll be interesting how to see how he gets on at Valencia, which is a track he seems to like.
I'm actually surprised that... And I have to be careful saying this, and frankly, it's a bit hypocritical because I got 10 years on him, but how someone in their late 30s that is running in, has run so many races at the very absolute top level, never ran into arm pump before, or debilitating arm pump, if you will, and didn't get it taken care of. It's a relatively simple operation. Yeah. I mean, it's disgusting if you understand the details of the operation, there's, as far as I know, if done obviously by a reputable physician, and of course these guys have access to the best, it's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, we saw, I think 2 years ago, Jorge Lorenzo had the arm pump operation. And apparently it makes a bit of a mess of your arms, but it works. And speaking of Jorge, we watched him slowly close the gap to Rossi, and again, with relative ease, coming down the home straight into the turn one, dispatched him and went, and ended up winning by 8.5 seconds. Valentino, second, very lonely second, but they both look really good. Now, that's quite significant when for the stat number crunchers, because Yamaha have secured, with that 1-2, they've secured the manufacturer's title, and if Jorge comes third or better at Valencia, he will break the record for the most points accrued in one season. But, and I'll come on to this a bit later on, I've got a bit of a thing about that.
I can't imagine.
I'm not here bigging up my boy. I'm going to say that the most successful, irrespective of the pure number of points, you have to look at the number of races run compared to the number of points accrued, because it's a points per race ratio if you really want to look at who's been most successful. And it's not Jorge and it's not Valentino, but we'll come on to that. There's a little teaser. We'll come on to that later. Dovi, fantastic ride by Marco Simoncelli, who really, and we've spoken about this last week, he really has come on strong towards the end of the season. And Dovi, we will watch the last lap for the last podium place, and Nicky all together in a group, Randy just off them, and Dovi, I was waiting for him to pass, thinking, come on. And Simoncelli is good on the brakes, he is really good. Yep. And you could see it was going to get difficult, and Dovi did what that Repsol Honda will allow you to do, and he made sure he was in the perfect position as they came onto the home straight, and he drafted past him and beats him by less than 1/100 of a second.
He
just clipped Simoncelli, and you could see the drive that bike has got, again really demonstrated well. But interesting, of course, Simoncelli's on a factory level, factory supported Honda Gresini, so well done Dovi. He got himself on the podium. Marco came fourth, Nicky fifth, Randy Depugne sixth, Colin seventh, Danny Pedrosa eighth, Marco Melandri, who must have been praying for it to stay wet, reasonably lonely, ninth, Hector Barbera 10th, Alvaro Bautista 11th, Hiroshi Ayama 12th, Loris Caparossi last of the finishers, and good to see Loris finish, however lonely his last place was, in 13th. Carlos Checa and Casey, of course, crashed out during the race. Alex Espargaró on the first lap, and Ben didn't get to start. So we've got Jorge on 358 points with that record tantalisingly close at 373, which was Rossi in 2008, I think.
I believe.
I've just looked at my numbers underneath. Yeah. Now, Valentino is currently in third place, and Danny is catchable, but he's 19 points ahead of Valentino, so he'd really need Danny not to score many points at all. Casey Stoner's on 205, so 12 points behind Valentino. Dovi, 10 points behind on 195, and then that's it. Ben Spies, due to the DNF, is on 163, tied with Nicky Hayden. So the top American is still up for grabs. They're both on 163 points, so that's going to be interesting.
Yeah, and
downwards.
As Spies has said repeatedly, top rookie there, you know, wasn't a goal that he was trying to achieve. It was simply the end result. But at least he he's got great takeaway, frankly, for the season.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, it's got to the point now where I don't think we're even surprised when he can go to a new track on a new bike and just be on it straight from the start. As James Whittam said when I met him and we were talking, he said, he's a freak. So I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that in the way that he's so incredibly unusual. And the fact that he just... And remember, he said to him last year, how do you do it? And he said, well, I just get on the bike and ride as fast as I can.
Indeed. I think you could reasonably say that he's an apprentice alien.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And next year is going to be fascinating on whether he can go up to the next level and how far he can take that next level with the factory bike.
No doubt. Yep.
On the going back to the stats thing we mentioned, I was just looking at a few numbers on MotoGP.com with their now really quite good and accessible statistics pages. Rossi scored the highest point score in the last 20 years with 373 in 2008. The lowest during the MotoGP era was Nicky with 252 in 06. And I started looking further back and comparing the number of wins comparing points to the number of rounds, because the number of races in a season has increased. Rossi's best result was 2003, because his race ratio was 22.3 points per race, which is incredible when you think about it.
Yep.
But twice that's been beaten by Mick Doohan. And I'm going to say, irritable and angry and aggressive as he is, Mick Doohan is the points to races champion. In 97, he got 22.66. That was 340 points out of 15 races. And in 94, he got 371 points out of 14 races, which gave a ratio of 22.64. And to beat that race-to-points ratio, these days, with 18 races, you'd have to score 409 points or more. And I thought, wow, that was the most dominant performances we've seen in recent times.
No doubt. And something else, if you wanted to go further back and actually kind of try and analyze that stuff in a Martin Raines type of manner, I believe the point structure for first through wherever has been changed multiple times over the years too. Not within recent memory, but certainly in the past.
Yeah, and it becomes really complicated, and you need to be a mathematician or a statistician with a far greater grip on things than I have. Another interesting stat that came up, this was just mentioned in Motorcycle News, and I had to double take and go back and check. In the 800cc era, this was before Estoril, but as it turned out, Estoril didn't change anything. Looking at the most wins, Valentino Rossi's had 21 wins. Casey Stoner's had 23. So Casey is the most successful 800cc rider, and depending on what happens next year, may well remain there. which is something I think a few people will raise eyebrows at. But when you think about it, you know, Valentino did have 07 was just a terrible year, and Cases was all conquering. And obviously 08 and 09, although Valentino's won, Casey's been picking up wins as well. So he's kept his nose out in front. And then we came on to some silly season roundups in the MotoGP paddock, and it was confirmed that Randy Depugnet will be going to Pramac Ducati next year as Tony Elias moves back into the MotoGP paddock to ride with Lucio at LCR. And I thought, well, considering the year you just had, what? Why would you do that? There's obviously going to be an awful lot of stuff going on behind the scenes, and it's probably sponsorship. The dollar sign's going to get its way in there somewhere, or the euro sign. And so there we have it. We have RDP off to Pramac Ducati to join Loris Caparossi, and Tony Elias coming into LCR. And I think everyone's going to be looking forward to seeing Tony. As Toby Moody said, here comes a bike rider alongside with that incredibly distinctive riding style. Aleth Espargaró, as it's been confirmed, it's a great shame that he's going to be leaving the MotoGP paddock, but I'm convinced we'll see him back. Mm-hmm. And he's going to ride for Sito Pons in Moto2 next year.
Yeah, and frankly, he's still a kid. We kind of forget about that because he's a big guy in some ways. I mean, stature-wise, but he's a kid.
Yeah, exactly. He's only a young lad, and he's done enough, I think, to make people, you know, make a note of his name and just keep it on file for the next round of silly seasons. So depending how he does next year, I'm quite sure we'll see him back.
All right, so the Premier class had an awful lot of drama in it. Certainly the Chase pack, you know, although it was a runaway win, and we don't always like to see that, I do have to give a tip of the hat to the Dorna cameramen for catching some great action back in the field.
Yeah, yeah, it was good. It was good watching Colin carve through them and then run wide and have to do it all over again. He seemed to be having fun out there, though, which has not always been the case this season. That was good. And that just leaves us with two more races to cover.
Just.
Might sound strange, because they were both in the same class. You know, it's funny, we talk about this as if, you know, we don't want to give things away, but thinking, how many of our listeners haven't actually watched this race again and again and again? I don't, if anybody hasn't, guys, you have got to watch the 125 race. It was possibly, there was one element of it which may be the first chapter in a legend, but we won't know that for years to come. So anyway, we started, like the other two classes, in the dry. The wind still creating some problems. The 125s lined up, and because we had this strange no qualifying, it was all done on aggregates, we had an unusual looking front row with both Bradley Smith and Danny Webb. For the British-based listeners, both on the front row. Mark Marquez was third row. Paul Espargaró was back in the third row. Tirol, I think, was second row, wasn't he?
Yep.
I haven't got the qualifying grid in front of me, actually, as ago. Anyway, they set off. Mark Marquez started tearing through people, bearing in mind, as we went into this race, both Marquez, Tirol, and Espargaró all had mathematical opportunities to still be in the hunt, but they needed, Espargaró and Tirol particularly, needed to try and finish ahead of Marc Marquez. So the race starts, first bit of drama, Sandro Cortese, who at time I think was running fourth or fifth, just behind Paul Espargaró, appeared to clip the back of Paul's bike. Eurosport didn't think he did, they just thought he went down. I thought he did. But anyway, for whatever reason,
we did have a second angle on that they showed later in a replay of the race, and it actually looked like he was probably about 5 feet off him, but in the angle from the outside of the corner, it looked like he cut his front wheel on Spargaró's rear wheel. But
he did just crash independently.
Yeah, the other one was basically a straight-on shot as they were coming out of the corner, and he was, it at least appeared to me for him to be way off, like, it, you know, 5 feet away. So, yeah, that was odd. But, you know, turn one was pretty hungry in the 125s.
Yeah, a lot of people went down there. So Sandro Cortese goes down completely independently to his crash. There's another crash behind, which involved four riders, I think, and then collected a couple more. And one of those bikes came sliding through. It may have been Danny Kent's riding the Lambretta. And poor old Sandro Cortese just stood up and gets hit by a bike coming from behind that just sliding on the deck, which hits his ankles and absolutely flips him in the air. Thankfully, it would appear he's not too badly damaged, but there were a lot of retirees. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. There you go. Yep. 13 retirees. And the race developed, and we had the usual suspects pushing up the front. Bradley Smith trying to do the teammate thing and protect Nico Tirola, got out front from Marc Marquez, which lasted a while. And then Marc got past, and we had a interesting situation when it started to rain.
Yep. And so one key point here that I should make for all of the listeners is a race will be declared wet or dry at the beginning. But that really only matters in the MotoGP class. And they didn't indeed declare that race dry, and it turned out to be dry. In the case of the 125s and the Moto2 class, it kind of really doesn't matter, because if they're not at third race distance, they will stop the race or open up the pits, and riders can come in and swap tires. So, bit of a different situation, but typically in 125s and Moto2, they will shut it down, let teams do whatever they need to get prepare the bikes for impending weather. But the weird thing about Israel, and much like, not much like, but a lot like, for example, Sepang, is that the clouds are just streaking across the circuit, and so you never know where water is or rain is coming down, and odds are it won't be there the next lap. So really crazy.
Yeah, and I mean, through all the races, you could see there were still damp patches. So we had this rain started on lap six, I think. Mm-hmm. We hadn't done enough for it to count. We hadn't done enough laps for it them to say, right, it's red flagged, and that's a result. So unlike World Superbikes, where they'll do a second race and take aggregates, they said, nope, red flag. And the first bit didn't happen. Now, because of this major crash we'd had, bearing in mind these guys have only got one bike, the restarted grid only had 17 riders on it.
Which is phenomenal, considering the 125 grid.
Of 29 regular riders plus wildcards, something like that.
Yeah.
So they went back in. But this rain, as Jim was saying, I mean, this rain was ripping through, and but then it went. So they've come back in because of the trying to meet the TV schedule windows and all that and keep within their time slots. They said, right, the restart will only be 9 laps. So this is going to be a sprint. Most of the riders said, no, it's that shower came through. They've stopped it, but the shower's gone. We're going to go back out on slicks. Paul Espargaro took a gamble and said he was one of, I think, only 2 or 3 riders who said, no, I'm going to go out on wets. They didn't have time to cut any slicks, if they're allowed to. I'm not even sure if they are.
Yeah.
So it was full wets he decided to go out on. So the pit lane opens, they go out. Marc Marquez, on the sighting lap, crashes. And it was an incredible crash. Lost the front, and he's holding on to both clutch and throttle, keeping the bike going, when they both get flipped, and he still holds on to it. There's bits of bodywork flapping off, gets the bike upright, he's kept it running, gets back on, rides round, goes back into the pit, and the mechanics, they've only got the one bike. Absolutely incredible. They were stripping bits off it. At one point, you can see him saying, come on, I've got to go, and I thought he's going to go out on a naked bike.
Yeah, no.
He's going to go out on a bike with no fairings.
I thought the same thing as well.
But in a way, it actually played into his hands that he was too late anyway. The pit lane had closed. So he knows now he's starting from the back of the grid. So the mechanics took and they had something like 3.5 minutes to get all these Zeus fasteners back done up and get the bodywork back on it.
One thing that I thought was really cool about that was that it was not just that team. There were teams on either side of them that were pitching in crew guys just to keep it going. And I think that was...
There were some different shirts in there.
Yeah, phenomenal.
And I can't remember who it was. It might have been Spalders or it might have been Toby Moody laughing, saying, and if you see anyone from the Aspar team in there, they'll be taking bits off.
Yeah.
And which did make me laugh, but no skullduggery at all. So Mark Marquez goes out, and this guy's leading the world championship, but not by many points. And you're thinking, hang on, you know, the pressure now, he's just crashed. What's gone before is irrelevant. Nothing counts so far. This is the race. It's 9 laps. You're starting from the back of the grid, albeit a 17-wider grid. They restart, and he went from 17th to 5th by the time they came out of turn one, lap one. I mean, this, he was on it. And I just thought, no, this is Ian Oni. He's going to crash. He's going to do an Ian Oni. He's going to go tearing through. The adrenaline's going to come down, and he's going to crash. And did you see the pit board? They kept putting this pit board up, going, third is fine, second is good, stay with... And as Julian Ryder and Toby Moody were constantly saying, this kid is 17 with the world championship at his door. He is not going to pay any attention to that. And he didn't. I mean, Bradley did a sterling job of trying to keep him off Nico Tirol. It didn't work. And... I just thought Mark Marquez rode a masterful race. We know he's quick. But Nico Tirol is a really, really clever rider.
Oh, yeah. You know, he dropped the pace once he realized that Marquez didn't want to pass him. And that was very wise, because it allowed Bradley to get up there. And once again, with like 4 laps left to go, start to bang on him. But we should talk about the other turn one crash that we encountered in race 0.5.
Yeah. Being the...
There was a whole slew of guys that went down there.
Oh, yeah. And concerns that the earlier crash might have put some oil down, or the might be, but when you got the aerial shot, there were dark streaks where the track was not drying in certain places. And I know it's quite well known for having varying road surfaces, Estoril. It's not the... it's a bit like India, I think. There's been different bits of resurfacing done, and it does change in consistency as you go. And we had even more guys going down. Tommy Kayama, I remember, was one, and can't remember any other specifically, but the going back to the Mark Marquez thing about not wanting to go past Nico Tirol, we were continually seeing him drafting along that long main straight and then sitting up.
Yeah.
Just to keep himself tucked in behind. And there was an inevitability, I think, to what happened when he got past Tirol. And it was close. But I just remember thinking at the time, you know, is this one of those times where when people look back and they'll say, you know, Mark Marquez, MotoGP world champion 2021 or whatever it may be, and they'll say, yeah, do you remember when he was 17, when he crashed on the restarted Estoril race sighting lap? And, you know, it was incredible. He won, and you could see just how elated he was.
At the same time, you could see how gutted Tirol was.
Yeah, Nico Tirol, I think you could see on his face, he's basically, he won't admit it, he's only 17 points, I say only, he's 17 points behind. Because Mark Marquez has won so many more races this season, he only has to finish in the 8th or better for it to be wrapped up championship this weekend at Valencia. Paul Espargaró had gone out on wets, ended up finishing 10th. He is now mathematically out of the picture. He cannot win.
That being said, even a 9-lap sprint on full reins is incredible to come in there.
Yeah. I mean, he was obviously relying on another shower to come through. And if it had, genius, and he may well have been the only rider upright at the end. You know, it was a good run. I mean, the finish was Marc Marquez 0.15 of a second behind with Nico Tirole, and 0.212 seconds behind Marc Marquez was Bradley Smith. And Bradley, obviously, he may have been able to draft and pass Nico Tirole. He wasn't going to. He's, you know, it's his teammate. And he said he's going to, you know, be a good teammate. Although he did say on the post-race interview, looking forward to Valencia where maybe I can race with more freedom. And I thought, yeah, Bradley, come on.
Yeah.
You know, it's if Nico's winning and Marc Marquez is ninth, I don't think Bradley's team would be very happy if he were to overtake the leader, because that would cost them the championship. But I'm sure he wouldn't do that. He's a smart kid.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was incredible.
We should note, because I don't think we had our notes, at least, that I believe Bradley Smith has signed with Tech 3 Moto 2 for next year.
He has indeed. Yeah. Bradley and Mike D'Amelio, yep. Which, you know, I mean, I quite accept. We were sort of discussing through the show notes before the show, and I was saying, huh?
Yeah.
It upset me a bit last year when Aspar took D'Amelio up, but not Bradley.
Right.
And I was thinking, sorry, not D'Amelio, was it? It was Sergio Gadea. I was thinking, but he's not even had that good a season. But, yeah, Mike D'Amelio, former 125 champion, the guy can ride. He just hasn't worked for him this season. 20th, he sits in the Moto2 World Championships. But he's going across to Tech 3. Bradley's moving up to Tech 3. Now, Marc Marquez is interesting. I don't believe he's nailed on as staying in the 125s next year yet. You'd think he would. But if he's world champion, why would he want to stay? Particularly with the changes coming around with Moto3 in 3 years' time. Moto2's already changed. MotoGP changes the year after next. There's nowhere for him to go but down.
Yeah.
You know, he's world champion. So I wouldn't be hugely surprised to see him move up. Nico Tirole has said he's staying for another year, and that's going to be his last year, isn't it, because of his age.
Yeah, I think we're kind of hearkening back to the days of yore, if you will, with rider contracts and whatnot. You know, people think of the silly season as sort of being concentrated in between, say, the mid-season break. This is the classic one in modern times, mid-season break to maybe the last or second to last race.
Yeah.
The shit started up at the beginning of this year, and it's not done, and we're about to run the last race of the season. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah, and of course we've had this situation with Moto2, where I think I've got the notes here somewhere. Yeah, we've got Moto2 have now confirmed that they're not going to drop to 36 riders for next year. It's going to be 40. So they have reduced the grid, but not by a whole load. There are 18 two-rider teams and 4 one-rider teams. Teams have 1 week to confirm their rider entries and pay their deposits to IRTA. So that's more than we expected. And the Rossi and Neri will be glad to know that Uccio's team, WTR Racing, are in there. So it looks like they're going to be one of the one-rider teams with Andrea Iannone. But the riders haven't yet been confirmed.
Mm-hmm.
And they've had this strange thing. I think it was brought in to try and reduce the amount of silly season activity that went on halfway through the season. And they've basically said, no, you don't confirm your riders until right at the end. So, you know, stand by for some major announcements this weekend.
You know, I will politely disagree. I think probably one of the best things that can happen to MotoGP and, frankly, any of the top flight series is for silly season to start as early as possible, because what it does is get the fans talking and talking and talking and talking incessantly. And it's completely fan-driven, frankly.
Yeah, yeah. There is that, yeah, you're right. And I know that Eurosport's viewership has slightly increased. This was a story in Motorcycle News about 2-3 months ago. Since BBC came in, Eurosport viewers has actually gone up slightly, which we all found strange. Then we thought, what might be happening is the BBC get the casual Sunday afternoon, what's on set? Oh, there's a bike wreck. Oh, don't know who these people are. Wow, that's quite good. Start to get into it, want to know more information. If they mix with people who, you know, are serious hardcore fans who know the names, the numbers, who's what, they might want to watch Moto 2 and 125, and they might want more insightful and technically based commentary, and they go to Eurosport. So I suppose there is that thing that interest generates interest, which generates interest. So, yeah,
very true.
It just gets a bit. It gets a bit tedious though. When every week it's like, well, what's going on here and what's going to happen there, and we all knew about Rossi to Ducati, and very quickly, speaking of which, Jeremy McWilliams, who is at McWill99 on Twitter, put out a cracking little tweet, and he said, would it be possible for Honda, Ducati and Yamaha's factory teams to be put next to each other at Valencia in the pits? That way the teams haven't got so far to walk on Monday morning. just made me laugh.
I like it. One thing that I have to remember too, so we know we're going into Valencia this weekend, the last race of the year. The only championship left to be decided is in the 125s, and that should be fun to watch. And as we mentioned before, Martin, was all the testing that's going to go on. There is kind of a whisper, rumor, I haven't been able to confirm it yet, with Eskil Suter, who we had on last week's show, an interview I recorded earlier in the year. But InMotec will be out there with their 800cc prototype to see if it can't run some competitive lap times. I think that's pretty cool. Will it? Who knows?
With an 800 or the 1000?
With an 800.
With an 800 in it, right. Yep.
The InMotec
one that we've been waiting to see all season.
Yep. BMW derived.
Yeah. No, that would be interesting. And we mentioned this on the pre-show chat of... What's there going to be more focus on, certainly in the MotoGP paddock? Is it going to be the race, or is it going to be the testing? Monday is just Moto2. Tuesday and Wednesday is MotoGP.
Let me clarify that for you. It's going to be Moto2 and journalists on the GP bikes.
But on Tuesday?
Monday.
Oh, on Monday, sorry. On Monday, yeah. I don't believe there's Eurosport coverage, but you should be able to. The subscribers to MotoGP.com should be able to get some. I don't know if it'd be live, but there certainly should be some video. But there'll be some good news coming out, and that's just going to be so interesting.
I'm going to throw out a plea here, and a public plea, and I think it's appropriate for all of our fans, because I'm guessing an awful lot of you guys actually subscribe to the feed from MotoGP.com. Dear Dorna and the folks that run that, maybe Michael Morrell or whoever puts all that stuff together. But please, 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 and I think I've said this many years, do not expire our subscriptions on Monday or Sunday night. Let them last through the tests so that we can get a feel of things to come. We pay an awful lot of coin to you guys, and the price for your off-season stuff is pretty steep. So keep us in. Keep us hooked. And at the end of the test, then get us to re-up. But do not kill our subscriptions on Sunday night after the race and not be able to find out about what's going on.
The thing is that the fans who pay that subscription, all right, if you extend it for the test, you're going to get a lot of goodwill and people are going to go, oh, that's really nice of them, and I can save myself the off-season subscription, so it might look like, you're going to lose money. But when we get round to the tests in February, we've had 2 or 3 months of no bike racing. We're all addicts. We're going to pay it anyway.
Yep.
So... in that sense, you know, you can't lose. You really can't lose.
Yeah, and to be fair, World Superbike is kind of a lot more open with their information. Just drop in there, because in this particular case, they weren't so much. So maybe I should eat a bit of my hat. But we did have my final second declaration and plea towards Dorna: split screens at the end of races. Split screens. You have to start thinking about that. Is not rocket science. Every other sport does it. It's fine to see the leader come across the line, but if there's a battle raging for the rest of the podium positions, do not cut away. I know the sponsors want that kind of thing, but you can't see you know, the logo on the side of the bike anyway. They're doing 200, you know, km an hour at that point. So that was a rant, wasn't it?
No, that was a plea. And that one goes to in front as well. You know, thankfully, Cal Crutchlow wasn't so far in front that we couldn't see Leon at Manicor stuff it up the inside of Max. We just caught it in the background. But it would have been nice if, you know, we could have done that split screen thing. And I know you've been preaching this one for a while, Jim, and I'm certainly in the congregation.
One thing I'll note, since we're going to drop in a little bit of World Superbike talk here, they announced, I think, a few months ago that they did have this in the past, and I remember watching it, and it kind of faded away, and I was like, you know, part of you is missing when you're enjoying World Superbike. But onboard cameras are coming back next year, which should make for a great viewing season.
Yeah. Yeah, and certainly, I mean, that series, you get so much close racing. It's going to be fantastic.
Yeah.
I don't know if they'll be able to run to these gyroscopic cameras, but they are just amazing. I mean, the one on the back of Ross's bike, you just keep thinking, well, he's crashed. Oh, no, mm-hmm. That was just him turning a corner. Oh, he's crashed. No, that's him turning another corner. The lean angles are just outrageous, but it really brings it into perspective when the camera sits upright and you just see this body disappearing from side to side of your screen.
No doubt. No, you know what? Actually, that reminds me, speaking of lean angles, I'm going to drag you all the way back to FP1 and the three crashes from three well-talented individuals of Jorge Lorenzo, Nicky Hayden, and was it Casey Stoner?
Casey Stoner, yeah.
All in pretty much the exact same corner, I believe, going or coming out of the inner parabolica. And in the wet, those high sides are slow motion. They kind of come around, and you know, at a certain point, especially with the bikes that these guys are riding, there's not a lot of saving if you're about 10 degrees off kilter, front to wheel, wheels in alignment. Luckily, nobody got badly hurt, because that would have thrown a real wrench or spanner, as you would say, Martin, into the points lead at the end.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, that was the Jorge Lorenzo high side was the one which prompted Eurosport to wonder if mm-hmm. Danny couldn't have made some good use of an airbag suit, because it inflates when the rider's separated from bike or exceeds a certain angle. And it was inflated in midair. You can see it coming up, and the way he walked away with slowly deflating shoulders, which literally, as opposed to metaphorically, but probably metaphorically as well. Yeah, I mean, fantastic bit of kit, and obviously does its job in that environment.
Slowly deflating shoulders. I had a mental picture of some poor lad, you know, at the pub when last call's already done, and he's looking at the ratio of men to women and realizing it's not very favorable. Slowly deflating shoulders.
Going home alone again.
Yes. Again. So as we mentioned, or as I kind of segued around to the backside of it, World Superbike did do a fairly comprehensive test, and I don't think between the notes here, you and I have all of it, and granted, any times that come out are unofficial at this point, but it kind of gives you a bit of an idea. But a bunch of guys were out there. Run through that, Martin.
Yeah, we had Max Biaggi with his newly signed contract, Ink Now Dry, remaining at Aprilia for 2 years, was quickest, and quite significantly quickest. And this is on the slightly amended 2011 RSV4 with with gear driven cams that have caused so much controversy this year. So that's not made a whole load of difference. And this is testing, and it's you know, it's so early in next season, it's actually still in this season. Carlos Checa was second, which was very impressive. And Tom Sykes, the new ZX10 or ZX10, just is really looking good. And he was third quickest, with Leon Camus on the other Aprilia fourth. There weren't a whole load of teams. Ten Carter weren't there. The Leon Haslam BMW was still continuing to make progress. I think he was fifth or sixth quickest over the weekend. But certainly, I like Tom Sykes. I've always liked Tom Sykes. He's a real breath of fresh air. In fact, he's almost Whittam-esque. Quieter.
With a wider smile.
And with a... He's just one of those happy-looking chaps. Everyone likes... Very popular with the XBSB guys. You know, that Brit pack, as MCN are fond of calling them. You know, they are pretty tight. They socialise together. And Tom certainly... it's been brilliant to see him. I mean, just thinking about... It was Imola, wasn't it? Watching him and... It wasn't Fonzinietto, he's in Moto2. Trying to think who it was, watching them back in their bikes in through every corner, and people thinking, that's quite hard to get past because he's broadside. Brilliant to watch, but that Kawasaki had issues this year.
Yeah.
And next year, it really does look like they've put a serious effort in, and I think we may see the... Oh, in fact, it was you that mentioned it, Jim, in an email of... seeing it in national and international series next year, it may well do a BMW S1000RR and just start appearing in super stock races all over the place and doing really well. So, and I know as a Kawasaki man, you'll be glad to see them back.
I will. Frankly, it would be nice to see them back. I still hearken back to the times where Nakano and Olivier were running, I believe they were running at the same time, with when they made that slight color shift change to these sort of sparkly lime green with sparkles in it. And that very subtle change actually just threw that bike out to me as just an aggressive bike, even though it frankly wasn't running in the front. It still looked badass.
Well, I still think one of the best-looking MotoGP bikes is the Rizla Suzuki. It's, mm-hmm. I think it's beautiful, particularly in this year's slightly darker blue, and you don't get to see it very often because it's at the back.
Well, there's no doubt that particular, you know, kind of happy color shade lends itself well to what are probably the most fine stable of Umbrella Girls.
Oh yeah,
in the paddock, the Rizla girl.
I've never wanted to be arrested so much in my life.
Yes,
when you get the Suzuki, Rizla Suzuki police girls.
There are a couple of pictures. You know, it is those of you that also know that I run rideon2.com, RIDETWO.com. I've got, you know, 50,000 plus pictures, and of many of which are bless you, Rizla Suzuki squad and Paul Denning in particular. There's a bit of a Paul Denning story on the BSB side as well, but we can't get into that with the time we've got. Absolutely excellent, gorgeous pictures. So, and I'm speaking very specifically of the lovely lasses that support that squad.
Before we alienate all our female listeners, I think we're yet again falling into male chauvinist areas.
I don't think so.
Because, no, we're not. We've never left them. We've always been in the male chauvinist areas. World Supersport, Lucas Gasser, Chaz Davies' new teammate in the BE1 Triumph team, was the quickest in testing there. Half a second ahead of Chaz, who's been testing a whole load of new stuff. Brock Parks on the smaller Quack, the ZX6, came in third. And that's going to be an interesting series.
Yeah, you know, Brock Parks filling in for Johan Lescours at the end of the year rode really well, and frankly, I think that's his. He's got an opportunity to come back. You got to remember that I believe it was Eugene Laverty who took over his ride when he was riding for the Factory World Super Sport Squad back in 2008. Was it he or Foray?
No, it was Eugene took
Foray.
Craig Jones's place, didn't he? Craig was killed.
Yeah. No. This was when he did the one off at the end. Two or three off, frankly. Starting off at what circuit was that? Everybody will know except for me. And he had the dice up with Andrew Pitt, which eventually led to Andrew actually going down. Eugene finishing up on the podium for his first super sport race, so which was fantastic. And by the way, I've been trying to talk to Eugene. Folks out there that listen to the show, and I know you became fond of him and big fans, been trying to talk to him. He's been very busy, obviously, and he's traveling around Europe preparing for his super bike season. But if you happen to grab his ear, I'm trying to go through the pseudo-bureaucracy now of Yamaha Racing, and it's a little bit more difficult. They used to arrange it through PIPA. Eugene, you are wanted back on the show. People want to hear what you have to say and hear what your thoughts are on your 2011 season. Now, there is a plea, Martin.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not a plea for me. It's a plea for the listeners. I'm getting asked so much that he come back on the show. So.
And just speaking of Yamaha World Superbikes, Massimo Marigali has, I think everyone knew it was coming, there's been a bit of a round robin in Yamaha MotoGP, with Massimo Marigali coming in from Yamaha World Superbikes to become team director, and he'll work closely with Wilco Zeelenberg, who's team manager, and obviously Tom Houseworth, and Massimo's reunited with Ben Spies, because of course he was team boss when Ben won the World Superbike Championship last year. And Davide Brivio, now this is interesting, we've had half the news.
Mm-hmm.
Yamaha have announced that he is indeed leaving. No news on where he's going. Send your suggestions to where that might be on a postcard to motopod.com, etc., etc., etc. We don't know. He may not turn up at Ducati. He may become officially Valentino Rossi's team manager or personal manager. We don't know.
Think about this, Martin, which was an interesting crossover, and I think a lot of us were like, what the hell? You basically had Livio Supo a couple of years ago, 2 years ago, who was the eyes, mouth, and voice, and everything for Factory Corsa Ducati, and then made the switch to Honda in quite a different role, although I'm sure that there's plenty of overlap, and kind of makes you wonder, okay, where is Davide going to end up? I wouldn't be surprised if he didn't end up either as a consultant. He's not going to walk away from motorsports and go open a poultry shop somewhere.
No.
And so I suspect we'll be seeing him, but we'll probably hear something this weekend, frankly.
Yeah. I think a lot of things will be tied up this weekend. And, yeah, we've certainly got an awful lot to talk about before the season really is done and dusted and put away for the winter.
Absolutely. A couple more tidbits. Guy Martin did sign with Taz, and that's kind of a big deal in the real roads racing scene. He's been working with Park Keller for a couple of seasons and much beyond that, but never quite hit that mark that he wants to. So it looks like he's going full hog. On top of that, I did talk to Mark Miller today via email, and we're going to do the pre-Macau bit for next week. I think I mentioned that at the beginning of the show.
Yeah, that'll be really good.
It will be very cool. Sorry there were no interviews in this one. Well, I'll leave that aside because you never know between now and tomorrow night. But once again, enjoy Valencia and come on back all the time and take a listen to us.
At motopodcast.com.
Or motogpod.com for the time being.
Absolutely.
Cool. Hey, Martin.
Good stuff.
Martin, thanks for joining us, which is the proverbial we.
Yeah, the royal we.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to go back to bed. It's 7 minutes past seven.
Yeah, it's currently Thursday night, and Frank, I don't know if you're going to be able to go back to bed, because FP1 is about to start.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be interesting me watching this weekend, because we're the family, we are going away to see friends on the other side of the country, which sounds impressive till you remember that Britain's about the size of a postage stamp. But it's still a 3-hour drive, so we're heading off this afternoon. Once we've got Mia out of school, we're going to go and break her out with some kind of escape plan. So we're going to be staying with friends who don't have any interest in bike racing, so I'll be saying, could I just see what's on telly? Thanks.
And then an hour later, you're like, can somebody bring me a beer?
Yeah.
All right. Listen, once again, thank you very much. We will be coming to you once again shortly and have a whole bunch of information for next week. If you'd like to, and thank you once again very much to those of you that are donating to MotoGPOD to help keep us afloat. Very, very helpful. You can One method, and probably the best one, is to do it through the Facebook page for the original MotoGPOD fan page. You can also do it through the website at MotoGPOD.com, or probably at MotoGP or Moto. This is going to be hard. I have to train MotoPodcast, MotoPodcast.com. We do have new stickers coming with the new logo, which is almost identical to the original, which means that the old MotoGPOD stickers, which some of you may have and be hoarding away, are suddenly far more valuable, at least to your personal
you
preference.
You demonstrate your veteran listener status displaying the originals.
Indeed. I was there then. What does this also mean? Those of you that are interested, and this will be a complete not-for-profit situation, much as the stickers are going out. We should have T-shirts soon. And I might even float some ideas by you guys on the show, or maybe through the Facebook webpage, or right on 2.com for cool shirts. And that'd be neat. All right, let's wrap it up, Martin.
Fantastic. Just before we go, Jamie McVeigh's had his habitual weekly mention, and just like to say Alex Beverell and Big John Hart, because we always like to mention them.
Yeah, yeah.
We haven't so far.
All right, cheers. My best to Sharon and Mia and Martin. I will talk to you, as well as the rest of you out there in MotoGPOD /MotoPOD land. Thank you so much for listening, taking the time to visit us, and send us an email if you'd like through the contact form on the webpage, or however well you can do it.
Fantastic. Thanks, everybody. Cheers, Jim.
And all right.
Good morning.
Good night, Martin.
Ta-da.
Ta.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for flying with MotoGPOD Airways. We trust you enjoyed your flight. We'd like to apologise for the complete lack of any in-flight catering, but hope we made up for it by the superb quality of the in-flight entertainment. We look forward to seeing you again very soon, and please remember, as you leave the programme, ensure you take all your baggage with you. Thank you, and good night.